Chemists were astonished, textbooks rewritten, a scientific myth destroyed, and Neil Bartlett triumphant. All this happened 10 years ago when a bit of scientific heresy was committed in British Columbia. This is Stuart Finley for Men and Molecules, presented by the American Chemical Society. Today, a report on the successful challenge of a scientific myth. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, pilot, essayist, poet, once wrote that men must launch canoes into the night. His meaning was that man must constantly explore new ground, often inadequately equipped, and often with uncertain consequences. Neil Bartlett successfully launched a canoe that explored and illuminated an uncharted field of chemistry. All that happened in the early 60s when he was at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, having joined the brain drain by emigrating from Great Britain in 1958. Dr. Bartlett is now professor of chemistry at the University of California at Berkeley. We caught up with him at a meeting in Toronto, where he reminisced on the achievement that eased the path to Berkeley. At British Columbia, Dr. Bartlett busied himself reacting fluorine with various materials, including platinum. In one experiment, he heated some platinum wires surrounded by a cloud of fluorine gas. Out came a red solid that Dr. Bartlett, after some difficulty, identified as a combination of platinum, fluorine, and oxygen, the oxygen having come from the glass vessels in which the reaction took place. A further study of this compound, interesting in itself, revealed an astonishing fact, to a chemist anyway. Oxygen, which oxidizes materials, the rusting of iron, for instance, had itself been oxidized. In more specific terms, oxygen has been forced to give up electrons instead of taking electrons from other atoms as it usually does. The loss and gain of electrons is the primary event that determines what elements will react and in what proportion. In Dr. Bartlett's platinum compound, the classic role of oxygen as an electron acceptor, an oxidizing agent, had been reversed. It was forced into giving up electrons. Dr. Bartlett followed up his experiment with another one in which he used platinum hexafluoride, a molecule made of one part platinum and six parts fluorine, that had been created a couple of years earlier by the chemists at the Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago. If his guess was right, platinum hexafluoride should be able to oxidize, take electrons away from the oxygen gas in the air.
Now, it had been in the hands of the Argonne workers for about 2 years or more, and this worried us. Were we wrong? Would platinum hexafluoride not oxidize oxygen? Or had they simply, and this seemed inconceivable, failed to note that platinum hexafluoride would oxidize oxygen of the air?
Dr. Bartlett tried the experiment, mixing platinum hexafluoride with ordinary oxygen. He got a spontaneous, immediate reaction, even at room temperature.
At that point, of course, I became absolutely convinced that platinum hexafluoride was the most powerful oxidizing agent that anyone had ever had available as a reagent usable at ordinary temperatures and pressures.
With this formidable chemical tool in hand, Dr. Bartlett looked for even more dramatic ways to prove its ability to pry electrons away from atoms that would rather keep them. He quickly picked the inert gases as perfect candidates. These include argon, krypton, xenon, radon, and others. They're a group of elements that for almost 100 years have been considered impervious to chemical reaction, hence the name inert gas. They're also called noble or rare gases. They acquired their reputation as chemical virgins late in the 19th century, when chemists tried and failed to make them react. Later on, the arrangements of electrons in these inert gases nicely fitted developing ideas of why atoms and molecules do or don't react. Gradually, the idea that certain elements were inert became chemical dogma, transformed into obvious facts in textbooks. But some chemists weren't so sure. Linus Pauling, for example.
In 1932, that's the year I was born, Linus Pauling decided that it was quite likely that the xenon and krypton fluorides and even perxenates would exist. And he said so in an article which appeared in the Journal of the American Chemical Society in 1933.
Linus Pauling and his colleagues at the California Institute of Technology borrowed some xenon and tried to react it by passing an electrical current through a mixture of xenon and fluorine.
And they had considerable corrosion of their apparatus, and they report this in their Journal of American Chemical Society paper of 1933, but they were unable to conclude that xenon fluorides had existed. Well, it's conceivable that they didn't rule it out. Well, I think this failure must have influenced Pauling into thinking, well, his prediction was just not accurate enough. Certainly no other really serious attempts appeared.
Now, about 30 years later, Neil Bartlett was ready for his turn at cracking the chemical stubbornness of an inert gas such as xenon.
So went to one of my colleagues for a sample of xenon and asked him if he had xenon, and he said no, he had some krypton. What did I want the xenon for? And when I told him that I was intending to oxidize xenon, of course he laughed.
A bit shaken but still confident, Dr. Bartlett set up his experiment. He managed to obtain xenon, made some platinum hexafluoride, and was now ready to react the two. If it worked, it would dispel the myth of inert gases, provide the first compound of xenon, compel the partial rewriting of textbooks, and force the revision of ideas on how atoms and molecules combine.
It took some time to set the experiment up, several days, and in fact I wasn't finally ready to run the experiment until rather late in one day, about 6:45 in the evening. And my two graduate students, they were both recently arrived, graduate students, had left for dinner. It was clear from their absence that they weren't particularly optimistic too. So when I broke the glass septum separating the two gases, the xenon and the platinum hexafluoride, this is incidentally a very colorful reaction, because the platinum hexafluoride is a red gas and of course the xenon is colorless, and when the two gases were able to mix, there was an immediate reaction to precipitate a yellow-orange solid.
It was a spectacular reaction, both colorful and historical. A colorless gas and a red vapor coming together, a yellow-orange solid showering out. Dr. Bartlett knew immediately that he had it.
Oh, there was absolutely no question. In that instant, there was the confirmation of all the theory and the absolute knowledge that indeed I had made a xenon compound. That's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of discovery.
Dr. Bartlett quickly confirmed that his product was indeed a xenon compound. For instance, he added water, hydrolyzing the material, and recovered xenon.
I demonstrated the reaction to a few of my colleagues, and they were startled, I think. It's very hard for me to sum up their feelings. My own feeling was one of some surprise that my prediction and fact had come off, and because you see, you always worry that you've made some approximation in the theorizing that may lead to the failure of the prediction. Everything worked out beautifully, and my feeling was one of considerable elation and relief that everything held together.
Ironically, Dr. Bartlett's experiment was never repeated with his original apparatus. A janitor accidentally smashed his equipment during the weekend.
Everything hung on one result, but I was sufficiently confident to rush into print, and I did, and I have no regrets. It of course was very much in my mind that surely everyone will now realize that xenon will be oxidizable, and particularly the argon. It turned out that no one had thought along those lines, and I think that the xenon hexafluoroplatinate paper came as a tremendous surprise to almost everyone.
Dr. Bartlett's paper appeared in the Proceedings of the Chemical Society. There was at first a deafening silence, much like the reaction he received when he attended a conference on fluorine chemistry in Colorado.
And I was greeted as I got to the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, with a group from Argonne, and one of the members of that group shouted, "We've seen your note and we don't believe it." But they hadn't, you see, had an opportunity to test it. After that meeting, and incidentally at that meeting, I announced that I had oxidized xenon as well, and this was to a large audience of fluorine chemists, and that remark elicited not one question, not one remark. I was really quite depressed after that, because I had expected to have some discussion, and there was absolutely no comment. Absolutely none.
There was no doubt in Dr. Bartlett's mind that his work was on safe ground. He calls it probably the best work he has ever done. And after they got back to the lab, his competitors at Argonne confirmed his results. Moreover, they now took xenon chemistry a considerable step further by reacting xenon with fluorine directly. There was no need for the intervening platinum compound.
Three of the Argonne chemists put some xenon or fluorine into a nickel can, heated the can to 400 degrees or there, about 450 degrees centigrade. It had about 5 parts fluorine to 1 part xenon. Cooled the can in cold water, took it down to liquid nitrogen temperature, pumped out the excess fluorine, then warmed it up and looked for the xenon. There wasn't any. And they pumped out of their can at room temperature a white compound that had the vapor pressure of a few millimeters at room temperature that analysis eventually proved with xenon tetrafluoride.
Several other combinations of xenon and fluorine were quickly prepared by the Argonne chemists. Others joined in. Theories of how these compounds could be formed started popping up in the chemical journals. Their physical and chemical properties were measured. But as Dr. Bartlett notes, even several years after the fact, considerable work remains to be done.
There are still difficulties in the understanding the bonding. We have, come a long way in appreciating what is involved in the bonding, but there are some interesting problems. For example, we still aren't certain about the molecular geometry of xenon hexafluoride. That's an important problem that still hasn't been completely solved, although the solution, I think, is round the corner.
Dr. Bartlett's achievement underlines several things about chemistry in particular and science in general. Chemistry is an inherently conservative science, and the almost total disbelief that greeted the initial ideas and results confirmed that. It's quite similar to today's situation with polywater, a very viscous liquid that some maintain is pure water that doesn't freeze. Most chemists are sticking to the safe, non-committal middle ground. Dr. Bartlett's achievement also underscored the danger of mistaking theory for fact. The inertness of rare gases, such as xenon, was based on supposition and some tentative experiments. It was accepted in part because it simplified current ideas about the nature of chemical bonding. Dr. Bartlett's exposure of xenon as a reactive material also confirmed a widely held belief that scientists do their best work when they're young. Dr. Bartlett did his when he was 30.
I'm sure that part and parcel of that is that the young man is usually a pretty ignorant fella, in that he hasn't yet taken hold of the theory so firmly that they have become a firm dogma with him. I'm sure that many more of us would be more productive if we made a complete switch of fields every now and again. But of course, and this is a really big problem, there are economic pressures that constrain us to work within the area where we know we are efficient. The biggest problem I have is that I recognize that the chances of me doing anything as satisfying for me as that experiment, xenon plus platinum hexafluoride, chance of that happening to me again is extremely remote.
Today, a report on the historical experiment performed by Professor Neil Bartlett.